Viola Williams, Reel 6. Yes, we left off last time, Miss Williams, and you were in Rangoon, and you were saying about, you know, describing your experience with the POWs of the Japanese. This 14th Army that you would have been working with, presumably, is known as the Forgotten Army. Yeah. Why was that?
Largely, I think, because for the last 2 years, or the last 2 years of war, there was so much concentration on getting over into Europe and finishing off the Europe war. And to a certain extent, I suppose, the Far East was a secondary concern, and they didn't like it. And so, in due course, they said they wanted to be remembered. And one of the things that they wanted was welfare, because they'd come all down through Burma and Malaya, and they just wanted somebody to take some notice of them. And the regular women's army at that point, the regular women's forces, weren't allowed, as far as I can gather, weren't allowed east of Ceylon. And so they had to have volunteers to do an odd sort of job, like going out to the 14th. And so whenever they wanted peculiar people, they always asked the families to go and do it. And I hadn't been able to get into a force because I was a spud pusher. But when this came up for volunteers for the Far East, the Labour Exchange said, "We can't stop you on this if they'll have you." And luckily they did.
Yes, you did explain so well last time, you know, about getting there. But I was wondering, when you met the troops of the 14th Army, did they really feel that they had been forgotten from your...
I think probably, I think as far as I remember, we only had one British regiment with us. The rest, it was Indian, you see. They were all various Indian nationality troops. And I don't think they felt so much that they'd been forgotten, because they were more or less in their own environment. But I think the Britishers, to some extent, did feel they'd been neglected and let down. And we were very glad. They didn't sort of welcome us overwhelmingly, but they just took us in as part of sort of general friendship. And my memory of it all is not sort of excitement, as of contentment. They obviously, both the Indian troops, because we used to go to quite a lot of the Indian activities. It was always a little bit tricky, because we were still vaguely part of the old India, which was the old Raj Sahib sort of stuff, and it was difficult being a cadet, officer cadet or whatever we were, because during the day you were working with the troops, but you weren't allowed to even acknowledge them at night, and it made it a little bit tricky, but most of us, it was that kind of atmosphere was completely new, and therefore we were going to ignore it. And to a very large extent, I think we did.
Were there many Japanese there at that time?
Where?
In Rangoon. Would there have been Japanese prisoners?
Not as far as I remember. There may have been, but I don't remember them in Rangoon. I remember them in Saigon, I remember them in Bangkok, and I remember them in Malaya, but I don't remember them in Rangoon. I think if they were there, the overwhelming tragedy of the whole lot of those men coming through probably overshadowed anything else rather than Rangoon. It was It was the only bit, I think, of my life that I really don't want to live again. They were so disoriented. One or two of them had sort of come through better than the others, but a lot of them were so frightened of the world generally. They'd been out of the world for so long, they were physically so feeble. And the one thing that they kept on saying was how wonderful their medical officers had been, the ones who'd been imprisoned with them.
Yes, I was impressed when you said how patched up they were.
They were, they were so patched up. It wasn't exactly protruding, but a lot of the sort of stuff had been done with bits of tin can, which was all they'd got. And of course they'd all got dysentery and they'd all got malaria. And it was nasty. That side of things, presumably, you or the War Office or whatever it is can get from people who actually went through the Burma Railway, but it was just shattered. And as soon as the bulk of them had been, bulk of the POWs had been shifted on either by boat or by air back to the UK or wherever they came from, Australia or wherever they came from, we were shifted round to deal with the troops who'd gone in to look after what was going on in what was then Indochina in Saigon. And that was such a mess. That was the most awful mess. We got parked in a... Did I tell you this before? We got parked in a hotel, and more or less, there wasn't anybody in the hotel except us. We lived, as far as I can remember, on crème de menthe and dried biscuits for a week. I've never touched crème de menthe since. And the Japanese were on guard in the front because the Japanese were the only people who could be trusted. There didn't seem to be much around in the way of British. The French were all fighting everybody they could see in sight. And as far as we could make out, the only people that they could trust with weapons at all were the Japanese, who had just surrendered. We were only there a week, but looking back on it, I mean, as a bit of war muddle, it was quite incredible. Anyway, they decided that they wouldn't let us out into Saigon because there was fighting still going on there. Presumably the local Vietnamese or whatever they were, or Indo-Chinese, and the French were not happy together. And I don't know what happened to the British, where they went. I don't remember seeing them at all, but we had Japanese all over the place. And they were quite happy, and we were quite happy with them too. And then they put us on a boat, and we went right down the Mekong again, and we went round to Bangkok. I think there must have been about 20 of us, I suppose, in our unit. 2016, 20, wasn't an awful lot of us. And we went round to Bangkok. I forget what vehicle we were on. It was a Navy war vehicle of some sort. And we anchored out in Bangkok Bay, and a gunboat of the Siamese Navy came to pick us up. And we were their first sort of female troops that they dealt with, and they were our first Siamese that we dealt with. And it was a most must have been about 2 or 3 hours the trip up the river to Bangkok, and it was the most convivial trip because they fed us on Siamese whiskey. which was a pale straw coloured and completely innocuous when you to the taste. But by Jove, it had some potency. And we had, it was the most convivial trip up the river. But again, at the final arrival in Bangkok was like the arrival in Rangoon. It was one of the things that I always remember, because it was a brilliant sunset, absolutely brilliant orange sunset. And as we came up, the Temple of Dawn, which is one of the most lovely buildings in the Far East, was black against the sunset. The water was the colour of the sunset, and on the water were little boatmen with little sticks just sort of sticking themselves across. And you've got these little boatmen black, you've got the Temple of Dawn black, and the rest was it was absolutely fantastic. I've been back to Bangkok so many times since, and I've never seen it like that before. It was such a wonderful, I suppose it was, in any case, we were all tight, and it was a wonderful welcome. They landed all our baggage about 20 miles down. They didn't bring the baggage up to Bangkok with us. They landed it all at Prahang or something. Anyway, it was about 20 miles further down. And so when we got to Bangkok, they took us to the mess where we were going to stay, but none of us had any baggage. So two of us who... We had no authority, but we were the only two that seemed to be able to cope. And we went back down to get the baggage. We managed to get some transport from somewhere, and we got the baggage from, I don't know where we got the transport from, anyway, we got transport from somewhere. And we came back with all the baggage. By this time, all the best places for beds in the mess had been taken. And Peg and I were landed with beds on the balcony. And at the time we didn't mind, but afterwards we were so glad. Everybody wanted to change places with us because we were on the balcony and it was cool. But we only got there because everybody else had got everything else. And then we just about got ourselves sorted when one of the really fussy females that we had one or two fussy females in our unit, and one of them said, "I haven't got my baggage, I don't know where it is." And so we had a look round to see whether we could find it anywhere. There was no sign of it. So, and Cherry, our Sikh, who was our bridge player, he was hovering around the mess to see if there was anything he could do. There were two of them who were very helpful, and Cherry was one of them. And Cherry said, "Well, I'll go back down to Pahang and see if I can find it." So I said, "Well, I'll come with you because I'm more likely to know what it looks like." And I careered off into the Siamese night on the back of Cherry's motorbike. I think also that probably would have been disapproved of by the Indian Army. But we found the baggage and we got it back. We found some transport that would be, it was all chaotic at the time anyway, because we were the first troops in and it was all a mess. But we got our baggage back, but I always remember her. I can even remember what she looked like standing there saying, "I haven't got my baggage."
What had happened in Thailand during the war? You know, what had done...
They had been sort of semi-neutral. I think the Japs had gone through, but I don't think the Japs had exactly taken over. There was no sort of sense of, like there was in Malaya, a sense of relief. I think the king, of course, had fled. He'd gone to Switzerland with his entourage. But then Siam, on the whole, didn't seem to have suffered a great deal during the war, either from military or occupation. They seem to be all right. We we did terribly well the first two or three weeks we were there, because we had a pretty hefty cigarette ration, and some of us didn't smoke. And the Siamese hadn't had cigarettes for quite a long time. It was one, I mean, they obviously have had shortages of things. And we could get practically anything we wanted in the way of silk and crocodile for cigarettes. For that, it only lasted about a fortnight, and then they realised what was happening. And after that, the price of everything went up. But that first fortnight was absolutely fantastic, what one managed to get hold of. And of course, they were all very clever artisans, so if you wanted a pair of shoes, they made the pair of shoes for you out of crocodile. If you wanted a silk evening dress, they would do that. That there was evening dresses, of course, that always made me laugh the whole time I was out in the Far East. Because during the day, you were wrapped up with long sleeves, long trousers, long socks, buttoned up to the neck. In the evening, you could go out in a bareback evening dress, and the mosquitoes wouldn't bite you. It was so stupid. We were lucky. We had a quite a nice mess in Wireless Road. The mess is still there. And we had Gurkhas on guard at the gate, and it was quite, can I tell you this? It was quite a long drive up to from the gate to the house. And we had two or three Gurkhas on the gate, sort of keeping an eye on us. They were so lovely. I still contribute to the Gurkha relief fund or whatever it is, because those Gurkhas were absolutely super. And I know Peg and I went out one night with the Gurkha CEO and one of his officers, and coming back, they said they'd take us right up. I said, I don't think you will. And they said, oh yes, we can't leave you out in the road. And I said, well, we'll see. And you know, those Gurkhas on the gate wouldn't let those two officers through, because they were not supposed to allow men into the mess, and it didn't matter whether it was their CO or who it was, they were not going through. And they stood at the gate and said goodbye to us. we went out with them several times, and every time they never got through. Which we were very glad about. I mean, the fact that the Gurkhas were prepared to, because there were all sorts of dacoits and God knows what about at the time, and they looked after us very well. Mm-hmm. Because I'd got a sort of agricultural cookery background, I was in charge of getting food into the mess, and this had its excitements, because the local market wasn't very far away, and I used to go down in the morning to the market to see, and I used to have to buy a goat, and I can't remember whether the locals wouldn't let us have the male goats or they wouldn't let us have the female goats, but there was one of the sexes we were not allowed to have, so we had the other one. And it meant walking back to the mess with the goat on the end of the string, and in the other hand, a bundle of squawking chickens. And we had a wonderful Chinese cook who was the envy of all the troops in Bangkok. And we never had any difficulty in getting people in every night, because they wanted to come and feed with us, because our food was so good. We had a wonderful Chinese cook. What happened in the background, nobody dared look at, but the goats and the chickens disappeared there, and they came back in beautiful food on the table. And because I was supposed to be in horticulture, I was put in charge of the garden, and we had a big garden. And in order to deal with it, I was given half a dozen Japanese POWs to do the work for me. And I went out because I got my canteen there. We've got two canteens, I think. Two of the ones that we'd had in the London Blitz, and we had them. We used them again in Bangkok, and every morning we used to go out to wherever there were troops of whatever nationality they were, and go and comfort them and rub ointment on their sores and their ringworm. It's mostly ringworm on their backs, and see that they had cups of tea and buns, and that if they wanted a letter written or if they wanted pencils or pens. The Gurkhas would never take a pencil with a broken point. They always look very closely at their points, and then they say no and give it back to us. And we used to write quite a lot of letters, and sometimes it meant sort of going round the corner and having somebody pour out their woes on us. But it was interesting, and we usually got back for a late lunch, because by that time it was probably very hot, and if we'd been flat out since almost the moment it was light in the morning, we usually used to rest in the afternoon and then go and fribble in the evening, but the Japs. One morning, I wanted a vegetable garden done because it was grass and sort of. I think there were one or two flower beds, but a lot of it was grass. And I wanted some ground dug to grow vegetables. So I explained to the Japanese in charge, at least I thought I'd explained to the Japanese in charge, what I wanted done. And when we came back at lunchtime, there was a lily pond there, nearly as big as the house. And they thought I wanted a lotus pond. And so they dug a lotus pond. And of course, being low on the river, it had filled up as they dug it. We could almost have swum in it. But they were very willing, and we got on with them very well, and we got some vegetables growing of various sorts.
How were they regarded by the troops, the Japanese prisoners of war? You know, bearing in mind the treatment meted out.
Yes, but the troops that we had were not the troops, not the army that had gone through the war. They'd fought them all the way down, but most of them, by the time the lot that came down through that were fighting them back into the sea, a lot of those were not newcomers, but they weren't. A lot of them weren't. A lot of the originals who'd been forced right back. That forcing back right through Burma must have been absolutely horrendous, and it wasn't all that funny coming back down. But at least they were going forward and not going backwards. And I don't think there was a great deal of their animosity against the Japs. I think the thing that struck most, certainly it struck the British people that we were talking, the British soldiers we talked to. Was that how the hell did we ever beat the Japs? Because they were so efficient. I know that it was finally the two nuclear things that finished it. But you see, by that time we were right back in Burma. We were right back down to Malaya, and we pushed them back. And there was. I think there was a great sense of slight puzzlement as to why, how we've done it. There certainly wasn't a great deal of, I never found a great deal of animosity. And the Japs, although they were, by that time, of course, they would be POWs, I never met any of them. And I met quite a few, both there and in Malaya, who were as one always hears about the Japs if they surrender, that they're supposed to be so ashamed that they commit harakiri immediately. But none of the ones, I think most of the ones that we met were damn glad to be alive. And they were certainly very, very helpful as far as we were concerned in every way possible. And they never took the slightest, made the slightest effort at an overture of any description. I mean, they were there to work, to help us, and that was what they did.
Were you getting refugees at this stage?
Yes. What happened? The king came back. Louis Mountbatten came to welcome him in. We had a great shenanigans for the return of the king and so on. And trying to drive a trap behind an elephant is no joke. But we had great. Yeah, great sort of excitement. And I think we had a surrender there, too, of some description. I think we remember having photographs of a surrender. But anyway, it was that was quite good fun. And I think we were enjoying ourselves there because we were doing quite a good job, so that there was a certain amount of job satisfaction. It was a social life that most of us had never had, or we certainly hadn't had for the last 5-6 years, and we felt we were doing a good job. Then, of course, the Indonesians rose against the Dutch as they were liberated, and we had boatloads of Dutch women and children. Arrive in Bangkok, and we were, as we were around, we were sort of there to give them a hand and see what we could do. And the first boat that came up hit a mine, and so that we not only had to some extent emaciated women and children, but we also had wounded women and children that we were dealing with there. It didn't last very long. From what I remember, the Dutch were ultimately, whenever there was a boat available, I think a lot of them went back to Holland. But we certainly had them there for 3 or 4 months, making sure that they were all right and that if they had to be hospitalised or do anything, that we were there, and just sort of being sort of generally matey and just sort of keeping an eye on them.
You were saying they were emaciated.
Well, a lot of them were very thin, because they'd been in Indonesia, they'd been in presumably in internment camps during the war, and there was no love lost between the Dutch and the Indonesians, so that a lot of them, they were not as bad as the Burma POWs, but they obviously had had a pretty rough physical time, and of course we were bursting with energy and felt rather guilty that bursting with energy.
Well, were they housed in camps, the refugees?
I have a feeling that we got most of them into buildings of one sort or another. Presumably, a lot of the people who had been out there as colonials of various nationalities had departed, and their rather nice houses were available. That's how we got our mess. And the one next to us was another lot of females of some sort, and they had a nice house too.